Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Passports, Please, conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. I am your co-host, Dr. Chick Morgan, the Cowgirl PhD diva, and with me is my co-host,
Rodney Bursiel,
the photographer-in-chief. Hi, Rodney.
Hello.
Good to see you.
You too.
We've been having some good conversations with folks, and we are really excited about today, aren't we?
I'll let you do the intro, and then we'll tell us who we're talking to. Yeah.
Well, today we have the fabulous Jonathan Bird, and we can describe him as a songwriter, a singer-songwriter, a poet, a photographer, and also to get us started, since we're talking about place, Jonathan, we'd like to know a little bit about where you are, because we understand you are a multi-generational North Carolinian.
Hey, Chick. Hey, Rodney. I am a seventh-generation North Carolinian, seventh generation to be born in North Carolina, and I have the eighth now. He's 10.
Aw.
Growing up fast.
My dad's family's from a town called Troutman. It's close to Statesville, kind of in the western part of the state. My mom's family is from Fayetteville, which is a little south and east of here. So we covered the state.
And does that give you some of the inspiration for some of your songs, which have such a grounded sense of place about them?
I'm sure more and more. I think when I was young, I couldn't wait to get out of here.
Yeah. You know,
it's a pretty common story. And then
yeah.
I did get out of here and I found out how cool it was here. And it was, you know, the more I left home, the nicer it was to come home and to realize what a great place I lived.
Yeah, I deal with that with being here.
Yeah.
I've been in Wimberley now for 25 years and I've tried to move away several times. And
I hear this giant sucking sound going, come back.
And it keeps me coming back. And I've, you know, Jonathan is, I mean, he's got a pretty big footprint here in Texas.
Yes,
and
he does.
We've tried to get him to come here, and just when you think you got him, he's...
nope, he's gone again. Well, Jonathan,
I love Texas. I really do. I really do love Texas. And Wimberley, the Hill Country, is my favorite part of Texas. Yeah. And the culture of songwriting and art. And there's just something special in the water there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's also, it's good to come home.
Yeah. Well, you've had a lot of that coming home in the last year. And it's great that we all live in places that it's nice to be quarantined in, if we have to do that, or at least not travel. But with your career and all of the touring that you do, what has it been like to be in one place, regardless of how nice that place is? Because we're going to talk a little bit later about some of the world traveling you do and some of the collaborations you do with people around the world. But what's that been like for you to just be put for a while?
Well, I tell you, I kind of feel guilty about saying how awesome it is.
Mm.
But it's really great. I've been traveling for 20 years. This is the first time I've spent 8-9 months in one place with my family, with my community in 20 years. And it's been, I spent time with my son, who's 10. I think it's made a big difference in how he's doing in school. I've spent that much time with him. And I see my mother every day. There's a woman that I'm very much in love with, and I get to see her.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's really awesome to be home. Mm. I think it's going to cost a little bit more to get me to leave home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I understand that part.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for both Rodney and myself at different times and places, my introduction to you was through Blue Rock Artist Ranch Recording Studio, which Wimberley is very proud to claim, with Billy and Dodie Crockett. And it was both as a performance, and you were one of the lead faculty or instructors for one of Blue Rock Foundation's songwriting retreats. So, Rodney, when did you meet Jonathan?
I met Jonathan at his, it was the first show that he did there. Yeah, because he's been numerous times now. But, I wasn't familiar with Jonathan before Blue Rock. And I had a lot of friends that had, you know, worked with him or knew him. And everybody was like, you're going to love this guy. Y'all are going to be fast friends. And, Yeah, it was just there's those people that you meet in life, and they're just that click,
instant connection. Yeah,
we just had that, and we've been close friends ever since. So
when did the music come into your life, Jonathan?
Oh, I don't know.
In utero, I mean.
You know, like, I don't know when I started playing. It was always a piano in the house. It was always a guitar in the house. And I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. So we sang, you know, every Sunday, mm-hmm. Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday.
And Wednesday. Yes. After training union, right?
Yeah.
With the potluck.
With the potluck.
That's right. We've all been there.
And then I sang a solo for the church when I was pretty young. I don't know, 7, 8 years old. So yeah, music has always been a part of my life, and I don't know exactly when I started playing. I know when I got a little more serious, I think it was in fourth grade when I started playing the flute in band in school. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't play the guitar, I couldn't play the bass, I couldn't play sort of rock and roll instruments, but I could play the flute, and it was in the key of C, so I didn't have to transpose.
I still do that.
Jeff Rotol had flute. Marshall Tucker Band had flutes. The flute was just cool enough that I could do that. I learned how to read music. And then I played, as I got into high school, I was able to play in a big band jazz program, which was very unique for the high schools. In fact, we went to conferences with universities because no other high schools had a big band. But we had an old big band player as our band director. So he organized this thing. I got to play guitar. I got to play a Rhodes piano. I got to play bass and learn how to read chord charts, which are completely different from written music. Then now you have to know how music is put together, and you have to put it together yourself. So that was a great, probably most of the things that I learned about music, I learned in 4 years in the big band program at Orange High School in Hillsborough, North Carolina.
It's interesting how many people we talked to that got that early, I wouldn't say start, but high school programs, school programs, school instruments that were really the influencing factor of a lifelong passion. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to see that continue over the coming years.
Yeah, and then my last year, they had these booths, these practice booths. And the last year, one of my electives was just to go play whatever I wanted to. I shut out the world and explore my instrument. And that was a fantastic.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So if you don't want your kid growing up to be a rock star, you need to keep him out of high school band then.
That's the moral of the story.
So
yeah, then I had bands, and I always played music. I was in the Navy. I came home. I worked at a grocery store. I had bands. I played music. And then when I was about 28, 29 years old, I figured out that I could pretty consistently write songs in this traditional style. I started learning acoustic music, old time and bluegrass, and the kind of traditional music of my area. And I realized I could consistently write songs that could be mistaken for anonymous. Right. And the thing is, you want somebody to ask you where you'd heard the song, where you learned it, where you found it, not if you'd written it. And I talked to Jack Hardy, who was in New York in the 60s on the folk scene. And he said it was kind of the same way. Everybody wanted to do that. Nobody wanted to be asked if they had written a song. Everybody wanted everybody to think that they had learned somewhere.
Well, did I, or maybe we had this conversation, or I can't remember if we talked about it or I read it somewhere, but weren't you in a metal band or something completely?
Oh, several.
Yeah, before you became who you are now.
Before he became Jonathan Bird.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that kind of music was one of the places where I could get a band on stage and I could be really nerdy. I could write stuff in weird time signatures and be kind of like write more intense music. Whereas, like, there wasn't really an outlet for jazz. There weren't any jazz players around. There wasn't another way to kind of enjoy myself as a musical brain.
And are there recordings of this? I want to hear Heavy Metal Bird.
There might be, but I hope not.
Extant recordings.
Well, mostly I played the guitar and I would do some songwriting, but we always had a singer. I didn't really start singing until I started doing traditional music. And I don't have a high voice. I don't have a loud voice. I don't have I don't have one of those voices that has the overtones that it takes to get over in a rock band or in a pop context. I've got more of a, you know, like a, a Don Williams or a Leonard Cohen or just kind of a little bit of a smokier baritone quiet voice. And so, you know, country music and traditional music is where that voice can live very naturally.
Oh, you had me at Don Williams. So excellent. Oh, what a talent. Those are the things I grew up on.
Relax a little bit.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I've been reading about you fairly recently and also from other musicians who happen upon this place is someplace, and I think it's near where you live, called the Kraken.
Oh, yeah.
The musicians and poets that we personally know that have played there, they speak of it in these almost hushed, reverent tones as being a very, very special place, a very special community. Can you tell us what that is and what your involvement with it is?
Well, our mutual friend, Nathan Brown.
Yeah, that's the one you caught me.
He came in and he walked up to me. He said, "This is going to be like getting a tattoo, isn't it?" And the Kraken is a very special, unique place. It's like our community clubhouse. Mm. You know, there's a couple dogs that wander through every now and then. It's kind of laid back. There's a barrel outside that, you know, when it gets cold like it is now, they light fires in the barrel and people gather around the barrel. It's special, and you can drive by it, and people have. You can drive by it for years and not really even notice it. It's just a little tin roof shack off the side of the road. But when you go inside and there's the lights and the bar and they have pirate flags that are hanging up. They're just strange kind of paintings. And some of the walls are painted red, where some of the walls are painted black. And it's got this kind of wild underground vibe. We had a TV producer come out recently. He was interested in how we were doing what we were doing, which we're live streaming every week. And we're using phones for cameras. We're doing this totally low tech, but it's very cool. It's one of the best live streams on the internet. The audio is great. We really figured it out. So he came out and he was checking it out. And he said, "You know, if I was producing a show here, or a show for you guys, I would just bring my truck here. I wouldn't even try to build a set." It's like, there's no way you can replace this kind of real vibe that you've got here. So the Kraken is run by Kirk and Jody. It's been around for, I think Paul said his dad built it in 1973, and it was just the bar. And then later on, they built this other room on it with the stage in it. And it's been through many hands. And now Kirk Schmidt and Jody Kidney own it. They're a married couple, and they're fantastic. They really have opened it up. They've invited a very diverse community into that place, whereas it wasn't always that way. So we've got young and old and black and white and Latino, and everybody's kind of mixing it up in there. And I've never even played really much for working class people. They've been touring the coffee houses and folk festivals, which really sort of middle class white intellectual is the audience there. So it's really opened up my audience to play there.
And you're still able to do the live streamings?
Yeah. So the first week of lockdown, you know, I was pulling what little hair I have left out, trying to figure out, like, do I do this in my garage? Can we find another space where we can do it? And then I realized nobody can go to the bar, and the indoor meeting limit is 10. So if we can get everyone to agree to abide by all the safety protocols, we can keep doing this in the bar. And if the bar owners, if Kirk and Jody are cool with it, and they said, okay. So we just never left. We just kept going back. The only change that we made is instead of facing out towards no audience, which felt really weird, we just turned around and faced each other. So now we play in the round for each other, and we put the campfire in the middle.
And that in the round has its own almost ancient traditional sense of place.
Yeah. Mm.
Mm-hmm. So how would people find that live stream? Where can we send the listeners?
We are on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, Twitch, and I even have a page on my website where people can watch if anything happens to the rest of that. So youtube.com/JonathanBird Music is our channel. We live stream from there every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern. And I also load up lessons, how to play my songs. I talk about lyrics sometimes. I've been getting into my own photography as I've been in one place for a while. And I've recently done a couple of things that I discovered as a photographer, the three lenses that I like to use. I just did a tutorial on my favorite kind of lighting and this lighting technique that I, as far as I know, I came up with it myself. It's my technique.
I was going to say, Jonathan has stolen my job. I used to be his photographer. Now
too bad, now, Rodney.
Now he's doing what you and I did for our photo shoot the other day.
Well, maybe he'll teach you how to write a song. There's always that left.
It's funny. Rodney is a great inspiration. I mean, you know Rodney's work. Oh, my
goodness. Oh, he's a genius. World class. I don't tell him that to his face, so don't tell him I said that, Jonathan, okay?
Yeah, since I've taught you photography now you have to teach us some songwriting, and I want to know more about Wild Ponies.
Yeah, that's one that hooked both of us very early on in knowing you. So
where did that come from, and what was the inspiration? Because that, like I said, when I first met you at Blue Rock, I knew nothing about you, and sitting in the audience and hearing that song. And I was even in the middle of, you know, some personal stuff, and that song hit me on so many levels, you know, from the story itself just to the horses, you know.
There's a town called Beaufort. It's a coastal town. Beaufort. There's a Beaufort in North Carolina and in South Carolina. North Carolina is Beaufort. In South Carolina, it's Beaufort. So Beaufort, North Carolina, is a town right on the Intracoastal Waterway. So people sail down from Canada. People sail up from the Bahamas along the coastline there. And Beaufort is a great stopping place. So there's a restaurant there and a bar. And actually, the dockmaster's office is kind of tucked into all that. And it's called the Dock House. I used to go down every summer, once or twice a summer. And I would play for 4 hours on the back deck of the Dock House. The thing about the back deck of the Dock House is it wasn't very big. There wasn't a lot of seating out there. And not a lot of people would come and sit out there anyway. People would actually sit on their boats. And the back deck faced the dock there. And they would come in every now and then. It took me a while to figure out, but somebody would come in, they'd get a beer, and they'd walk back out of the boat and say, "Hey, great, sounds great." And they're out there on the boats listening to my music. So I met a lot of great characters while I was there, and people from all over. And I did meet a guy who lived on a reinforced concrete houseboat. He took me out and showed it off to me. And I said, "That is going somewhere someday." How could that not be?
And what's the line?
I knew a guy who had a concrete boat. Don't take as much as you might think to float. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, you've mentioned that line to me before specifically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can kind of, it's a cone. You can kind of meditate on that line.
I'm doing that right now. Yeah.
I'm proud of that song. It's an exceedingly simple song. It has two chords. Touching. Talk about three chords and the truth. Well, this is chords and the truth.
Wow.
And it just oscillates back and forth between those two chords. It tells a very simple story. And this is one of the songs when I was learning how to teach songwriting and going back through my own songs and saying, well, what makes my song special? Why do people like my songs? What am I doing right? Because I'm a very instinctive writer. And it's something I kind of go by feel. If I'm tapping my foot or a tear comes to my eye or something happens in my body, I kind of trust my body to know that piece of writing is going to affect other people. I'm not a concept writer. I don't think I want to write this story that's about this and then I start making it rhyme. That's not how I go about it. I had these first couple of lines in a notebook for a while. She had legs like daggers and eyes like oceans and her heart locked up in a hard combination. Just pages of garbage after that, just pages of garbage. And someday I went back and I looked at those first lines. And I thought, okay, I get rid of all this other stuff, but that right there sets this beautiful scene that's kind of about islands and oceans and pirates and the combination lock and the daggers. There's so much in there. And I just started expanding on that with this piece of music that I had. And that's how I found the story.
Well, so the girl with legs like daggers, is this a real girl or is this an imaginary?
Oh, well, I mean, she's probably 20 or, real girls.
Yeah. A combination.
Well, I have a catalog of real girls in my mind.
Don't we all?
Moving on.
Oh. Adam Carroll says, all them girls on TV I never got to love. Yeah. I had that line. I don't know why I wrote that line. I mean, it was months after that I came back to the notebook and saw that there. And then it evoked all this other stuff for me. And so I said, well, who is she? What is she doing there? Who is this person who is looking at her? And what's he about? And so I started exploring those things. And when I went back to review my songs, and this is a song that comes up over and over. People request this song. People talk about this song. People ask me how I wrote this song. So I really explored this song. And what I realized about it, one of the things that I realized about it, was that it was really built on verbs. And it showed me, it brought to my attention that a story is built on verbs. Your characters have to do something in order to move the story forward. And so from then on, one of the things that I told my students is, if you ever get stuck and you're trying to tell a story, you're probably getting bogged down in describing things. And what you need to do is make your characters do something. Almost every line, make something happen. Put a verb in there. And this song, in almost every line, there is a verb. You know, I knew a guy who had a concrete boat. It don't take as much as you might think to float. We built a fire in the live oak trees and listened. We built a fire and we listened. And all those verbs keep coming back. And it's really that simple. And it kind of crowds out other words. It really makes you simplify the lyric, because you have to run and walk and throw, and you have to have these words in there that move the story.
So you're saying I should have paid attention in English class?
Well,
yes, do you want to tell him what a verb is, John?
I tried to tell you.
I think this would be a great place to play that song, Rodney, don't you?
Let's do it.
Wild Ponies.
She had legs like daggers and eyes like oceans, and her heart locked up in a hard combination. And I took her to the island to see the wild ponies. Now see, I had a friend who had a concrete boat. It don't take as much as you might think to float. And he lived out on the island with the wild ponies. And we made a fire in the live oak trees and listened to the pirate breeze a-blowing. Wondered how a man could be so far from home and still know where he's going. But she drifted down from a shipwrecked town and landed here on the Pamlico Sound. She'd heard out on the islands there were wild ponies. Well, I gave all I could give to her, a chance to see what she had heard. And a night out on the island with the wild ponies. But she didn't stay here like she didn't stay there, always looking for somewhere a little greener.
When I was in the fourth grade, I read a book called Misty of Shinkatish, which is about those the ponies off of, I guess, Virginia. And it so captivated me that it was 45 years later that I ticked a bucket list thing to see the ponies, that mysticism, that whatever that mythical thing is that transpires.
Yeah, it's funny. The I think Jonathan's aware of this, you know, the impact that that song has had on me.
Well, let's hear about it, Rodney.
Well, it's still to this day, it's my favorite song of yours. And I remember the first time I heard it, it hit me. And I remember talking to you about it at Blue Rock that night. And you kind of, you know, told me the story about where it came from. And we got on to the, you know, to the horses there. And you had invited me to come over to, you know, say, you know, you've got to come photograph these horses. And so I got online researching, and in the middle of my research, I come across the Camargue horses in France.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what are those?
The Camargue is the marshland down on the Mediterranean, and it's indigenous to that area. They're all white horses. It's all, they're smaller, shorter horses, but they're just gorgeous. And yeah, doing that research, when I ran across them, I think the next time I talked to you, I was like, sorry, Jonathan, I'm going to France. can't make it to North Carolina, yeah. But I've still got to get over and do that. But that song is what got me to France. And I've been, you know, 4 years in a row now. In fact, that was my first trip that got canceled because of COVID. That was last March. I
read somewhere that they are the oldest living breed of horses.
And you've probably done quite a bit of research on them yourself, because it's been kind of put on the back burner, but it's still going to happen. But I've been talking to Jonathan about we're going to do a book together. Mm. It's going to be all the Camargue photos, and Jonathan's doing poetry to the photos, and he's already written, you know, several of them.
Yeah.
So,
well, take some songwriters with you, Jonathan, because I know you're engaged in that and working with songwriters. I think that would be such an awesome combination.
Yeah, and I've done a little bit of I put some courses together. It's called the Online Songwriting Retreat. I haven't done it regularly, but every now and then I put some word out, and I can only take 8 people in a weekend because I spend one-on-one time with everyone. And so we meet on Zoom. I was using Zoom when Zoom wasn't cool before it was cool.
So how do people find out about that? How would I find out about your next one?
JonathanBird.com is my website, and you can join my email list there. And then I have a website, OnlineSongwritingRetreat.com, that is dedicated to that.
Okay.
And you can sign up for the email list on that if you're interested in those particular things. And we spend the whole weekend together. We get together on Friday evening, and we begin writing right away and talking about songs right away and bouncing ideas off of each other, listening to things, discussing them, asking important questions about the songs. Saturday, we get back together Saturday morning, do the same thing. And then Saturday afternoon is dedicated to one-on-one sessions with each student. And then Saturday evening, we get together and everyone sings or plays or recites whatever it is that they've written based on song prompts for that weekend. And of course, everything's incomplete. Nobody knows what they're doing. Everybody's nervous. People cry. It's really intense. And when people write, especially if people don't write a lot, they tend to dive very deeply into themselves. And so things come out. And some of those one-on-one sessions are really just permission. Is it okay for me to write about this? And it's always, the answer is always yes, especially if you have to ask. That's exactly the thing you need to be writing about. And then we get together one more time Sunday afternoon, and we do whatever feedback they got on Saturday night for playing or reciting or whatever they shared. They have worked on it a little bit, and we get back together one more time Sunday afternoon and share a somewhat more completed work. And people have really become fast friends. There are groups that I've done that they still meet every month. All 8 of them, they meet every month with songs. It's a very powerful process. And I learned Jack Hardy was a great songwriter in New York who ran the Songwriters Exchange, had a weekly Monday night thing where people had to bring a new song that they had begun that week, and you would get feedback on it. So I adopted some of that process. I fit in some of the process from the Blue Rock workshop that we did. I really liked that. I liked that we had one thing that we had that I haven't done yet is we had different writers taking different groups of people, and those groups of people would sort of switch off with different writers. Mm-hmm. You would get different kinds of voices and ideas. And that was really interesting. I like that about the Blue Rock Retreat.
Well, Rich Warren, a wonderful music critic from Chicago and also the host of that iconic show, Midnight Special, he listed you as one of the 50 most significant songwriters of the past 50 years. So clearly, whatever your process is, and I think I heard you at one time, that had been a Blue Rock, say you got up at 4 a.m. every day to write, which I just put that in pencil and said, well, he couldn't mean everybody needs to do that. But you are such a disciplined songwriter and acknowledged as such a craftsperson. What are the things that you think are the most important to impart to fledgling songwriters or even experienced ones? I mean, obviously doing it is is one thing and going deep, but how do you begin to communicate what that process could look like for us, for them?
You know, I really think that sharing is so important. Maybe not for everybody, but definitely for most people. I think when you share your songwriting or your writing or whatever, your creative work with other people, and you get honest feedback and you're able to apply that feedback and be honest with yourself, it really changes the game. It deepens everything that you can do. But I think sharing is so important to my own process, and also just to getting perspective. You can kind of get lost in your own laboratory and you know, fascinated with your own the back of your own hand. And it's good to get feedback, and especially in a group, because if you have, say, 8 people like we do, and 5 of them say kind of the same thing about your song, that's a pretty good indication that thing is either really great and it made them notice, or that you need to work on that part, or you need to cut that part out, or something to do with that.
So do you draw a line? I mean, all songwriters are writers and are poets in some way. Was there a particular point where you also described yourself as a poet as well as a songwriter?
Yes. What happened to me is I accidentally wrote a book of poetry.
I know this story.
I don't. I want to hear it.
So in 2008, maybe, I played a house concert in Hillsboro. It's a beautiful little town right here. It's the county seat of Orange County, North Carolina. I played a house concert there, and in between, in the set break, a lady came up to me and she said, "I'm an editor for Algonquin Books. And if you ever decide to write a book, I want it."
Wow.
And I thought, that doesn't happen to anyone. Mm-hmm. That's like a movie scene that you would write, and every writer who saw it would be like, "That's bullshit. That doesn't happen." But it happens. I was like, "Well, I better take it seriously." So I worked very hard to try to write a novel, and I could not get it together. But one of the things that I did in order to keep myself going was to work with words and story and character in really interesting, kind of abstract and very free ways. And essentially, I was creating poetry. So I have this big bulk of material that hasn't really worked out, and it's still kind of sitting there. I don't know what to do with it. But at some point, I realized, geez, I sure do have a lot of these other little things. And these look like poems. And I started going through them. And then I met Beth Wood's father. I can't remember his name now. Oh, it's terrible. Is it George? Oh. I feel so bad. Yeah. Mr. Wood. Mr. Wood, I'm very sorry. And I'll remember it as soon as we stop recording.
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, Beth just published a book of poetry with this Mescalita Press. And let me introduce you to this guy. His name's Nathan Brown."
We just had Nathan.
Had him on our podcast.
You know Nathan Brown.
We know him really well.
Great guy. And very ambitious, I would say. He has ideas, and he just kind of walks right toward them. You know, and I mean, starting a poetry publishing business right now is like, really? How does that work?
Yeah.
But the Mescalita Press has done such a great job. And Beth, oh my goodness. I mean, her first book was great, and her second book was just unbelievable, brilliant, moving.
Yeah, and she's won awards for it.
Yeah, big ones. Absolutely.
So I talked to Nathan and he said, yeah, send me what you got. And we worked it out, and I published my first book of poetry, which is called Youth Changed. And it's on my website, in the store. And I just had this whole new outlet all of a sudden. And somewhere in that process, I realized I was a poet, but I didn't realize it. I didn't say I'm going to write a bunch of poetry, you know?
Yeah, but when you and I started collaborating for this book, and I would call you and give you a subject, or I, you know, I need a poem on this, and he would send it in like 5 minutes. We've talked about this. I mean, there's just those people that what they do, it just comes so natural. And that's the way Jonathan is with his writing. It just, your head just must be, your brain just be bouncing around constantly.
It's a scary place to be.
Yeah. I think you told me that, you know, back when we could travel, you know, you're sitting on a plane with your iPhone writing songs or writing novels. And
oh yeah,
I'm like, how do you do that? I can't get a text out without, you know, a two sentence text without all the typos, and you're writing books on your phone.
Yeah, I don't know. I go through phases. You mentioned Scandinavia a little while ago, Chick, and
yes.
I did a European tour where I started in the Netherlands, and I went down to Switzerland, and I went back up to Germany and went into Denmark. And I spent about 2 weeks doing it. I did a lot of it on trains, and I did a lot of it solo, and I had a big suitcase and my guitar, but I kind of figured out public transportation. I just wanted to do that for myself. And I had so much time in my hands where I'd be on the bus, you know, just, you know, an hour on the bus in between places, and I would be watching people and interesting events were happening. It was winter time and the rails froze in the Netherlands, so trains all stopped and everybody was freaked out. I mean, the country can't run without trains. And so then we had to take buses, and then we got on, people that were supposed to be on trains got put on buses. People that were supposed to be on buses got put on trains, and the people would come through the train to check your ticket, you know, and they'd just be like, whatever. They would just punch it and hand it back to you. Like, we're not even looking at it. We don't care what seat you're in, where you're going. Hopefully you get there. And it was just an interesting time to be there. And I met lots of people, and those kinds of experiences, I think those kinds of days, it's almost like a natural disaster. Like natural disaster, it makes people talkative. It makes people leave their houses and get interested in what's going on. And you're looking around for coffee because you can't make any because your power's out or whatever. And so there was a lot of that. And a lot of people in Northern Europe especially speak very good English. So it was very easy for me to engage in conversations with people who were lost like I was, trying to find their way to Hamburg or whatever. And I realized when I got home after 2 weeks of that, I had written 50,000 words on my iPhone.
Wow.
In my notes, I'd written a book, a novella.
Well, are you familiar that we have just begun NaNoWriMo, you know, National Write a Novel Month, which happens every November for 50,000 words? You could have won the prize. NaNoWriMo. Well, your connection with Scandinavia, I find it's interesting just culturally, but the CD that came out, was that the one you did with the Sentimentals?
Yeah. Mother Tongue.
It was the same time I was being introduced to you as a songwriter. It might have been right before your songwriting workshop, and had been introduced to that. And it just absolutely stunned me as just such a brilliant concept. And the music and the thought behind them is just stunning. It takes a while to really sink in. And one of those songs, I believe it was on that CD, correct me, I'm sure you will if I get it wrong, Love is the Law.
Love is the Law, yeah.
Yeah, that is a stunningly moving piece of art.
Thank you.
That continues to touch me. And would you tell us the story behind that?
Okay, there are very few songs that I've written where I can exactly remember my process of writing them. Very few times. I don't really have a process. My process is to try different processes, and that keeps me motivated and inspired. So for this record, I had met the Sentimentals in Memphis, Tennessee. They'd come to the Folk Alliance Conference, mm-hmm. which is a big folk music conference, which is in Memphis, Tennessee for a few years in a row. And they heard my music and they said, we would love for you to come to Denmark and do some shows and we'll be your backing band. And we have a drummer and a bass player. I'm an electric guitar player. I have some of my own songs and we can do shows over there. All you got to do is buy a plane ticket and, you know, we can guarantee you X amount of money per show. So we worked it out and I went over there and it was part of that tour where I wrote 50,000 words on my phone. And it was the second half of that tour. It was a week of playing with them. It was so much fun. Great guys. And the places they put me up were beautiful. And I'd never really spent any time in Denmark. It was such a fantastic country, such a happy, reasonable, rational country.
Rational.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I could use some of that.
Great food and, you know, everything. Like coziness is just it's a national concept there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a concept in Denmark, and I can't pronounce Danish at all. I've been discouraged from speaking Danish, but it sounds something like hygge.
Mm-hmm.
H-Y-G-G-E. And the word just means kind of coziness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, have on a dark, damp afternoon, you have a candle at every table in your little pub. Or if you have outdoor seating in February, you just put blankets out there on your outdoor seating and people just keep sitting outdoors in Scandinavia in February. And you just kind of bundle up and there's this coziness that is revered by a nation. It's just so cool. So I loved it. I had a good time and I went back for another tour and they said, well, we need to make some recordings. We have something to like, kind of sell ourselves with. And I said, well, as long as we're making recordings, why don't we have some new songs? And they were like, oh, why don't we just make an album? Why don't we just? And we ended up writing and it always helps me to have a direction to write in. What am I working on? Like Rodney would tell me, oh, well, I need a poem about these guys that ride these horses and there's just a certain thing that they do. And I was like, okay, I've got a direction to write in now. So we decided that we would choose two really great philosophical and literary influences from our respective countries. And we chose Bob Dylan and Søren Kierkegaard. So Love is the Law, musically, is based on a song called Lay, Lady, Lay by Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear it in the phrase, Love is the Law, Lay, Lady, Lay. Like the scansion is there. And so what I did was I wrote out the lyrics for Lay, Lady, Lay on a piece of paper with a space in between each line. And then I started working with lines that had the same scansion as those words so that I could sing them to the same melody as Lay, Lady, Lay. So I'm adopting a form. It's like a sonnet or a haiku or whatever. I'm adopting the form of this song. And Lay, Lady, Lay has this really interesting form where the rhyme is not always the same or the repeated line happens at different places in each verse. So there's not a regular pattern. There is a pattern, but it's a changing pattern. So it's a very unique form. So I started working with that. And what I started mining an essay by Kierkegaard that was based on a passage from the book of Romans. And the passage says something like, love is the fulfillment of the law. And I started pulling ideas and images and things from that writing and putting them to the rhythm of this lyric. And that's what got the machine churning for that song. So as you go through the verses of each, you can kind of hear the melody. And I had to create a new melody and new music and get away from that melody. But the lyrics then suggested new music, a new kind of atmosphere for those new lyrics. And so I just kept bouncing back and forth between music and lyrics, and it ended up the bridge part of Lay, Lady, Lay I couldn't really make it sound like it fits. So I ended up creating a different kind of bridge part. And eventually it's, you know, you would never hear that song and say, oh, you stole that from Bob Dylan. You know, it's a long way from Bob Dylan and it's a long, maybe not as far from Kierkegaard actually, but it's just something that gets the fire started.
Well, and it's brilliance and concept. It's very Sondheimian too. I mean, it's just high language art form and a gorgeous, gorgeous song.
But Kierkegaard wrote about important things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing as important as love in all its forms.
Which we could use some right now.
Yes. Well, I have to say, in a very perverse way, that reminds me of one little short poem I came across of yours which is almost the diagonal antithesis of it, called Facebook. Do you remember that? I have it written down right here. It says, when I was young, I wished I could read people's minds. I've had enough now. Boy, everything you do is timely in one way or the other.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that. Chick just brought that to me today, so I'm going to have to... I will share that with credit.
Well, and speaking of sharing, I want to take a moment just to play Love is the Law.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Love is the law. Love is not ruled by laws. Love is the law. Love is not ruled by laws. Holy fire burning in your heart can't be divided like light from dark. Love is the law, love is not ruled by laws. All is enough, less is not love. The law is just, despite every rise and fall. The king is dead, long live the king. What can we give him who has everything? All is enough, less is not love.
Oh, wow. I just feel like we're doing some wonderful deep dives here. And where should we go next, Rodney?
What?
You always have good follow-on stuff. Well, how about you, Jonathan? Where would you go next right now? What else is on your mind and heart and that you could share with us? And maybe we'll let our listeners listen too, but we're very selfish about these things.
Yeah, give us something we don't know about you.
I don't know if you don't know this about me, but I'm conflicted right now because, you know, I have friends all over the country and I've made friends with parts of the country. It's like the Hill Country is almost like a person to me that I fell in love with. And like Shrewsbury in the UK is this gorgeous little town with such a beautiful history and such a great culture that I fell in love with. And I would love to be traveling and see those places, but I also love being home so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been good to be forced to be home for a while and to appreciate it in a very real way. Not appreciate it like, you know, if you work and buy your first car, you'll appreciate it. It's not like that.
Yeah.
It's more like, oh my God, but this is what I was missing in my life was that sense of community.
Yeah, it's I think we've talked about this on other episodes, but it really has been an interesting experiment, I guess, because yeah, in the beginning I didn't realize how much I was going, and it was nice to wake up every day and go, I got nowhere to go. I got nothing I have to do.
And it not be a bad feeling.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been very fortunate in, you know, with my career in photography and the things that I've been able to do. And I had some pretty big gigs with some, you know, pretty big names that all got canceled. And in the back of my head, I was going, I need a break.
Mm.
You know, I didn't miss it. But of course, now after 8 months of it, I'm,
bring
I'm
it
going
on.
A little crazy. I'm like, all right, bring it back.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was nice. You know, like they call it, you know, the big pause, mm-hmm. just to take it easy for a while. And it's,
Jonathan, has it influenced the kinds of songs you're writing now or how you're going about writing them? To be able to be embedded in this, your special community.
Yes. I'm really just getting a handle on that. But I think I've never really been a folk singer. That was the world. Folk is the world that songwriters fall into. You know, it's the venues that they play and the record labels that they're able to attract and the radio stations that will play their music, call themselves folk, and folk festivals would have songwriters there. And now the Americana world has that a little bit. But I never really felt like I was a folk musician, although I could play like a fiddle tune on the guitar or something like that. But I always felt like I was a songwriter, the same way that Dylan is a songwriter or Beyonce is a songwriter or Prince was a songwriter. You're crafting ideas that people need to hear, that they need in their lives, or things that they feel that they need a language for. We all need a language for love and for sadness and the things that we feel. We need a language for that. And the artists provide a language for us to feel by. So playing in this roadhouse for a few years and reaching the general public has definitely changed the way that I play. It's changed the songs that I play off of my own records. There were songs that I recorded that I would almost never play because they just didn't make as much sense out of the band context. There wasn't that same sort of musical conversation that can happen with between a bass player and a drummer, or between even acoustically between a fiddle player and a banjo player, and the syncopation and the, like I said, like the musical conversation that happens is something that I've always been interested in as a musician, which I was before I was a lyricist. So I have this deep, that's who I really am. I'm really a musician. I became a lyricist as a way of making a living as a musician, playing my own music.
Yeah. You don't really fit into one genre. Like I said, you know, singer songwriter or Americana, mm-hmm. or, you know, you are probably one of the more broad musicians that I know. It seems like everything you do is something completely different.
Yeah,
you know, you've got some that just sounds like straight out country music. Then you got the singer songwriter. Then you got, you know, folk. It's, yeah, you're just you're constantly. I don't know if it's reinventing yourself, but you're just.
Yeah, I always loved, like, David Bowie was like practically you couldn't even recognize him.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
like a different guy. But I did learn how to do kind of what people like that would do, where you can at least craft an album and kind of an era. You can craft a thing that you present kind of one thing at a time. Like The Law and the Lonesome, I always felt like was my Texas record. Mm. It doesn't all happen in Texas. It's not really all about Texas, but I wanted to feel like, could this be a Townes Van Zandt record? Could this be a Guy Clark record? Would this fit in Texas? So that was a guiding light there. Like, we had Dylan and Kierkegaard. It was sort of a philosophical record, and the band created a certain kind of sound out of it. So I finally figured out how to present just a piece of myself at a time to keep from confusing people too much.
Yeah.
But then when I'm playing a 3-hour show every week, I get to explore all that stuff, and I get to be a poet, and I get to play, I get to jam this like kind of West African thing on the bass, and then I get to play a honky tonk song and get people dancing. And it's fun, and I think I'm in just the right community that really doesn't care about genres, and they don't get put off by hearing. They love hearing different things, and so they accept me and they love me for that. It's a great place to be.
Makes me want to experience it, Rodney.
Yeah.
Well, you only know, we could travel.
You know what I haven't experienced with you in person yet, but when I first met you, you were doing the solo thing. I don't even think Johnny was with you the first time.
No,
and I don't remember. I don't know if I made the comment to you or not, but I had wanted to see you with the full band to really get the power behind you. You know, yeah. With the drums and electric guitar, and when the last time you came through Austin, you called to, you know, to do a photo shoot because you had a drummer now, and I still haven't experienced that in person, and I can't wait for that.
He's so great too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've never really been a solo artist either. I'm a musician. I want to play with other musicians. I want to have that musical conversation on stage. And I love watching a band and their musical conversation and the relationship that they have on stage.
You and Johnny are amazing together.
Johnny has taught me so much.
Y'all's dynamic is just, it's perfect. I mean, y'all go together perfectly.
Well, thank you. And he teaches me a lot about, you know, don't think about it so much. Just lean into it.
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah. Just like let the animal take over, and feel it. And he's so good with that. But he's also, on the other side, he's also such a theatrical person. And he has a great, I don't know what this is called, but he has a great awareness of his body in space. He knows what he looks like. He knows how his body is shaped from any perspective as he's doing things. And he just has kind of an instinct for that, or he's worked on it. I'm not sure how much is, you know, instinct or how much is what he's worked on. But I realized when I started working with him that I did not have that. I didn't really have a self-consciousness of what I look like to a camera or to an audience member, how my body is shaped in the light and that kind of thing. But Johnny's taught me a lot about that. And I toured solo for a long time because of economic reasons. It was just easy enough to pay the bills.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But I always wanted to play with other people. And Johnny is like just a once in a lifetime partnership. He's my Mike Campbell, right? Like Tom Petty and Mike Campbell or whatever. He's my guy. It would be hard to do what I do the way that I do it without him.
Yeah.
And now Austin is like that too. Austin has become and quickly became so integrated right away, learned the songs, and then was like, I wonder if I could sing a third harmony, which he'd never really done before. Taught himself how to do that, and then taught himself how to play bass on a couple things where he wasn't playing the drums. And it's just been a force, and everybody's fallen in love with him. He's a sweet guy, and he's got a great look, and people just look forward to seeing him every week. And there were, the first Halloween that we played together, two people came dressed as Austin.
Well, you know you've arrived, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, he's got the best hair in the business. So.
Absolutely.
That's great. Well, there are so many things to look forward to, even in this very difficult time. I look forward to participating in the Kraken and having that experience. And I look forward to what you and Rodney are going to create with the Carmarg horses some way or the other.
Yeah.
And to more wonderful music and poetry. And yeah. Rodney, how about you? What are you going to look forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to, in fact, when you were talking about that, I just got to thinking, I was like, you know, I need to get over to North Carolina and go photograph the horses there. And maybe that gets tied in with this book because it was the initial reason how I got over there. So
yeah,
maybe we can marry these horses and
Yeah, man. Gotta do that.
And you know, it's just a little car drive over, so maybe that's what I need to go do.
There you go. Yeah, don't have to wear a mask for 87 hours on a flight. So Well, those days are going to be here, and hopefully soon. And we just want to thank you. You're very patient with our techno glitches, and I'm sure we've got a lot of good stuff here. And so, Jonathan, thank you so much, and we hope you can get back to this, our neck of the woods, just as quickly as you can get here. Because
me too. And I think when we do start traveling again, you know, hopefully we'll all travel a little bit smarter, and we'll all be, you know, treat our bodies a little bit better and be healthier about it, and say no to some things that don't make as much sense.
Right.
I think the big pause has been good for everybody that way.
Yeah. Well, we're going to say thank you again, and we're also going to say thank you to our cast of supporters who helped make this possible, like our good friend Brock Glenn Thomas, who you already heard us talking about, our engineer and producer who bails us out of a lot of hot water. We also want to thank Rupert Neve Designs for our studio equipment. It's been just a joy to work with. We are not worthy of it in
sure
any
we are.
Way, but we are really enjoying that. And we also want to thank Donovan Frankenreiter, who has graciously provided our intro and our outro music. And we'd like to remind you that when you hear the words passports, please, you're in for adventures of the mind, the body, the spirit, and the heart. So until next time, we'll see you then.
He hugged the brush and ran the ridge. He dropped down and headed for the bridge. He dropped down and headed for the bridge, quiet as the rising moon. Quiet as the rising moon, I saw coyotes. The devil broke the rolling veil. A shadow rode along the rail. A shadow rode along the rail, black as the buzzard's wing. Black as the buzzard's wing, I saw coyotes.